This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at a rarely examined aspect of the criminal justice system, misdemeanors.
We're joined by Alexandra Natapoff, a law professor in California, an attorney and a former defense attorney, who wrote the book Punishment Without Crime, because what she writes about, misdemeanors, is really the gateway into mass incarceration.
We talk with two members of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, who gave up their liberty for perhaps the most pressing threat facing humanity today.
They wore ankle bracelets into our studio. The government is trying to thwart their legal defense and their travel. These people who broke into a nuclear submarine base in Georgia faced 25 years in prison for trying to alert the American people to the threat to all our lives.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In the overburdened U.S. criminal justice system, with a burgeoning prison population, we hear a lot about felony convictions. Felonies are crimes usually punishable by a term of more than 1 year, or even the death penalty. But what we don't hear much about are misdemeanors, low-level offenses punishable by fines or short terms of imprisonment in local jails. With 10 million petty cases filed annually, misdemeanors comprise most U.S. convictions. Unlike felonies, their processing is typically informal and deregulated. They have weak prosecutorial screening, an overtaxed defense bar, and very high plea rates. There is often little meaningful scrutiny to see if convictions are supported by evidence. Innocent persons who can't afford bail often plead guilty just to get out of jail. The misdemeanor phenomenon has profound systemic implications. It invites skepticism about whether thousands of individual misdemeanants are actually guilty. It reveals an important structural feature of the criminal system, that due process and rule of law wane at the bottom of the penal pyramid, where offenses are pettiest and defendants poorest. And it is a key ingredient in the racialization of crime. Misdemeanor processing is one way poor defendants of color are swept up into the criminal system with little or no regard for guilt. In her new book, Punishment Without Crime, University of California Irvine Law Professor Alexandra Natapoff takes an in-depth look at the misdemeanor system. Alexandra is an award-winning legal scholar and former federal public defender. She's also author of the 2009 book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. Alexandra, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin by defining misdemeanors. Are they all the same offense across the country?
The term misdemeanor actually encompasses an enormously broad category of offense and conduct and underlying behavior. The technical definition tends to be an offense for which a person can serve no more than 1 year incarceration, but that even that definition varies. There are 2, 3, 4 year misdemeanors, and some jurisdictions treat very minor low-level conduct as misdemeanors, loitering, trespassing, even in 25 states, speeding is technically defined as a misdemeanor. Basically, there's an enormous world of low-level criminal enforcement that sweeps in minor conduct punished in less serious ways than we have become accustomed to thinking about in relationship to mass incarceration, those long prison sentences. And it's a whole world of arrests and prosecutions and processing that just hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves.
And roughly how many millions of misdemeanors are there during any given year?
So I concluded from the research in doing this book that there are 13 million misdemeanors filed each year in this country. That's based on the data that I collected for 2015. And even that number should be taken with a grain of salt because The truth is that we don't keep very good track of them. Many states don't count all their filings. It's hard to get data. Often it's not public. So 13 million is the best number that we have available to us at the moment. And that's compared to approximately, between 3 or 4 million felonies that are filed in state court every year. So you can see that misdemeanors make up about, 80% of what it is our criminal system does.
And of those, roughly how many are plea bargained?
So we think that the plea rate for misdemeanors is about 95%. In other words, that 95% of misdemeanor convictions are the result of a plea. Almost no one goes to trial. The trial rates that I was able to obtain from states around the country hover around, 2 or 3%, sometimes even less. And notice that 95% plea rate is about the same as felonies. We almost never go to trial in this country. 95% of all convictions in this country are the result of a plea. But the dynamics of taking a plea in the misdemeanor world are quite different than the dynamics of taking a plea in the felony world. The pressures are different. Often people are pleading guilty because they can't make bail, and they're facing less time in jail if they plead to get out than they would be if they were willing to stay in jail to fight their cases. So while the plea rates are approximately the same, it's important to understand the differences in the way that we put pressure on people to plead guilty.
And one clarification, if I'm arrested on a misdemeanor, do I have the right to a trial?
The right to a trial, yes. Many of the criminal procedure and constitutional rights that we accord defendants for felonies are the same as we give to misdemeanor defendants. There are a few key differences. Probably the biggest difference is the availability of the right to counsel. The Supreme Court has essentially held, because misdemeanors are considered more minor, the punishments are considered more minor, that we're going to make it easier to impose convictions in the first place. So if you are facing a misdemeanor charge in which you cannot be incarcerated, and there are many so-called non-jailable misdemeanors on the books for which you would sustain a criminal conviction, it's just the punishment would not include incarceration, the court has held that you are not entitled to counsel. We also see that as a matter of practice in these low-level courts around the country, people are often not given counsel, even when they are constitutionally entitled to it. So the big procedural difference, even though technically people have the right to counsel, people have the right to a trial, is that often these low-level courts don't enforce those rights in the same way.
I assume one of the things wrong with the misdemeanor system is its impact on poor people and people of color. Is that a factor?
That's an enormous reality about our low-level criminal system. In fact, as I write in the book, I don't think we can really understand the misdemeanor system and indeed our entire criminal system, of which it constitutes the lion's share, without understanding the pervasive and profound role of both money and race in shaping that system. Two of the chapters in the book are entitled Money and Race, as a way of trying to drive that point home. Many low-level crimes are what we call crimes of poverty. They only happen to poor people. Driving on a suspended license, for example, is often a crime of poverty because people's licenses get suspended because they cannot afford to pay traffic tickets. They can't afford to pay the fines and fees that go with sort of the routine realities of driving in this country. Wealthy people of means, can pay those fines and fees, therefore they're never faced with the criminalization of their need to drive. As we've been seeing, particularly after the Department of Justice report on Ferguson, that many low-level offenses generate fines and fees that people cannot pay. And even if they wouldn't have been incarcerated for the original offense, people are being incarcerated for failure to pay the fines and fees. So we've created this kind of new debtor's prison based on people's inability to pay within the criminal system.
Alexandra, I love statistics and I love your book, but let's put a human face to some of these misdemeanors. Can you share an example of how a low-level offense has ruined someone's life?
So I love statistics, but I don't think that we can really appreciate the significance, the democratic significance of our misdemeanor system without engaging what happens to real people, what happens to real families when they encounter this process. There are just so many ways of understanding that. So, for example, in the money chapter, I describe the stories of a woman named Ms. Rodriguez, who was a resident in Tennessee, and she, at 50 years old, she was living on Social Security disability benefits because she had hurt her back, and she was charged for the first time in her life with the crime of shoplifting. Her punishment, $500. She couldn't pay $500. She was close to indigent. And so the Tennessee County put her on what we call a pay-only probation. In other words, she was farmed out to a private probation company to supervise a year of probation during which her only obligation was to come up with the money to pay that $500 fine, which she did. She turned her disability check over to the private probation company. She lost her car. She fell and broke one of her teeth, but lacked the money to fix her tooth because she was giving all her meager resources to the private probation company. At the end of the year, she had paid over almost $500 in fines, and the probation company said no. You are still on the hook. Why? Because every month the probation company had been charging her fees, what we call supervision fees. Every time she was drug tested by the probation company, they charged her a fee. When they issued a warrant for her arrest, they charged her a fee. And so at the end of that year, the private probation company told her, you're still on the hook, and they went to court and asked that she be kept on probation to continue to generate that revenue stream. And this is just one example of an entire industry of essentially wealth-stripping private industries that are feeding off the revenue streams generated by low-income people, by poor people in the misdemeanor system in ways that are literally driving them deeper into poverty.
Someone who's been arrested on a misdemeanor has to put that on employment applications and other forms. Talk in general ways about the overall harm to individuals and to our society by this misdemeanor dilemma.
The point about criminal records is such an important one. Because our misdemeanor system is so big, it touches so many people, those 13 million cases every year churning people through the misdemeanor system. And what they're doing is they're conferring arrest records, they're conferring criminal charge records and conviction records. They may be sending people to jail. They're stripping them of their wealth and their resources, often their driver's licenses. And so one of the arguments I make is that we should understand this not just as a criminal system, but as a social policy. It's a way that we handle low-level conduct, low-level disorder in ways that are profoundly destructive of people's ability to thrive, to function in our economy, to work, to obtain education, to take care of their families. We are imposing the burdens of criminal records, of criminal experiences with the criminal system in ways that are undermining people's ability to work, to thrive, to learn, and to care for themselves and their family. And it's profoundly destructive. If we were to engage in a cost-benefit analysis, we would have to ask, is it really worth going after people who have trespassed and loitered or failed to pay a fine or engaged in some low-level disorderly conduct to ruin their lives, to convert them, for example, into a source of revenue for this low-level system in this kind of self-perpetuating way? So the argument is to take a step back, to ask, should we really be handling these kinds of questions in such a punitive and economically destructive way?
We're speaking with Alexandra Natapoff, who's a law professor and attorney about her recent book, Punishment Without Crime, an excellent book. Alexandra, let me ask you about how what we've been talking about relates to the phenomena of mass incarceration, because I'm not sure, my own view is that it's really not much of as much a cost-benefit analysis, is that it's a method of warehousing people, mentally ill people, people that can't find jobs in this economy, and they end up in prison. And my own view is that the misdemeanor system helps facilitate that.
So I think that over the past, you know, decade or so, we as a community, as a political community, have come to understand that mass incarceration has been a terrible, destructive, racially skewed mistake, that it contributes to racial discrimination and racial inequality in this country, that it's a way of warehousing people for punitive and weak reasons. But what we haven't recognized is that the phenomenon actually starts much earlier, that misdemeanors are actually the first step, that first moment in which the criminal justice net reaches out and sweeps people in for weak reasons, for poor reasons, for racially disproportionate reasons, for reasons based on poverty and disadvantage. And that the misdemeanor system is where we first start to give people records, to give people criminal experiences, to treat them differently in ways that can haunt them in their interactions with the state and with the criminal system for the rest of their lives. And so while mass incarceration has taught us an enormous amount about the injustices of the felony system and of our prison system, we need to extend those understandings all the way down, as it were, to the bottom of the pyramid, where defendants are poorest, where the crimes are pettiest, where we haven't paid enough attention to that destructive dynamic.
I attended a conference last year at Columbia University. It was called Beyond the Bars, and the featured speaker was Angela Davis, who herself had spent some time in prison. And she's come to the position that, with the exception of some, you know, horribly violent people that need to be confined, that prisons really should be abolished, that they don't serve a constructive purpose. But what kind of society would we need in order to do that?
I think misdemeanors, they provide an important window into this profound question of what kind of society we want to live in. How do we want to treat each other when we engage in conduct, for example, that is disorderly, that is unpleasant, or more seriously, that is violent or antisocial? And it's in the misdemeanor realm that we see how thoughtlessly and carelessly and often inhumanely we make that decision with respect to the lowest level kinds of conduct, conduct that is often not harmful, conduct that's often not dangerous, order maintenance policing, for example, which has been a subject of great controversy in New York and Chicago and L.A. and around the country, where low-level offenses like disorderly conduct or loitering or trespassing are heavily enforced, I would say over-enforced, on the theory that it's going to reduce crime up the food chain, that it's going to reduce more serious offenses. And what we've ended up doing is criminalizing and incarcerating and punishing millions of residents, often poor people of color, in the name of fighting crime. We are starting to understand what a destructive public policy that is. And I think that the question of the abolition of prison reflects a larger question of what we think our criminal system is for in the first place. And even if we were to abolish prison, if we continued to round up 13 million people every year and charge them and punish them for misdemeanors, we would still have a massive over-criminalization problem on our hands.
Alexandra, I am a huge fan of your previous book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. And I like both of these books because you've emphasized aspects of the criminal justice system that don't receive quite as much attention. When you were researching and writing the misdemeanor book, what was the most eye-opening or even surprising takeaway for you?
First, Heidi, thank you for the comment about the snitching book. I just want to note that in some ways I think that the spirit behind the two books are very similar for me in my mind, that it is these enormous aspects of our criminal system that don't get attention, that are kind of swept under the rug, that are written off as unimportant or informal or low status, that do so much of the troubling work of criminal justice. Under the table deals with criminal informants or pressuring vulnerable people to become informants. These low-level misdemeanor courts in which people are swept through without counsel, without due process, without understanding their rights and who are overpunished. That it's to understand our criminal system, actually, it may be the most important to look at the arenas where no one looks, where there is so little information, where we haven't paid attention, because that's where some of the greatest injustices occur. When I was researching the misdemeanor book, you asked me, you know, what was most surprising to me. And I have to admit, the whole thing is shockingly surprising to me. I can't believe that we pay so little attention to it. It's shocking that it's so big. It's shocking that the Constitution is routinely violated every day for thousands of people in these courts. It's shocking how often we lock poor people up merely because they're poor. It's shocking the kind of low-level conduct that nobody thinks is terribly harmful or dangerous that can crush people's lives in these ways. So I think the whole thing is surprising, and it goes to your point. It's so important to try to get more information about this enormous aspect of the system that we really have just permitted to slip under the radar.
During your research, did you encounter specific individuals or aspects of the system where people really are trying to make things better?
So it's one of the actually kind of exciting things about the misdemeanor system is that there are places all over the country where people are pushing back, where people are filing lawsuits, where people are putting pressure on their local officials to do things differently, and it's possible in part because it is such a local phenomenon. American criminal justice is, for the most part, local. It takes place in cities and counties and at the state level. The federal system, of course, makes up a very small aspect of our entire criminal system, and so there is, for example, many jurisdictions, as the result of litigation or public pressure, are changing their cash bail systems. They're moving away from cash bail and looking for different ways to run the low-level criminal system that does not involve imposing hundreds of dollars worth of burdens on poor people who can't pay. There have been lawsuits against, a recent lawsuit, I think it's in Arizona, against a prosecutor's office that is charging people for diversion. In other words, that individuals can qualify for diversion, being diverted out of the criminal system and avoiding a criminal record, but many prosecutor offices charge a fee for that privilege. And there's a lawsuit challenging the use of the diversion power as a revenue-generating mechanism. After the U.S. Department report on Ferguson, the country's eyes were opened to many of the dysfunction of these low-level courts, and we've seen changes in many jurisdictions all over the country in response. So there are a lot of things happening, sometimes in ways that are not particularly visible, but it just shows how much potential there is for change.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question about the various fronts where people are pushing back on the system, Ferguson being one. After the horrific murder there, they elected a progressive prosecutor who's rolling back on when people were being charged with misdemeanors, and then the government was financing itself on the fines. I've been following the campaign of Chesa Boudin in San Francisco, who was active in trying to eliminate cash bail, and who talks about how most people in jail in San Francisco are there because they're drug addicts or they're mentally ill. He's running on a program of diverting these people out of the criminal justice system because jail is not something that's going to help them. Some kind of social programs are something that's going to help them. And I think that phenomena is picking up all over the country.
I think that's right. There are a number of New prosecutors, recently elected prosecutors, or prosecutors who are now running for office, who are taking very seriously this kind of change and this kind of reform. Rachel Rollins, for example, in Boston, who's the first African-American woman ever to be the district attorney for Suffolk County for Boston, she ran on a platform that included the promise to decline 15 different low-level misdemeanors, meaning that the office would presumptively not convert those arrests into criminal charges absent some pressing reason to do so. And those charges were things like disorderly conduct and loitering and trespassing. And she won on that platform. And I think what that tells us is that people are starting to recognize how costly, how unfair, how racially skewed many of these very old standard run-of-the-mill misdemeanor processing practices are, and they want to see prosecutors who are willing to change them.
Alexandra, how can our listeners read more of your writings or learn more about you and this issue?
So the book is available on, you know, on all kinds of online platforms, of course, and Basic Books is the publisher. You can get it on Amazon. I've written a number of, there's a number of smaller pieces. There's an op-ed in the New York Times that is available online. There's a podcast that the Center for Court Innovation has just released, in which I talk at more length about the misdemeanor system. There's a segment on C-SPAN's Book TV where I talk about it. So there's a lot of information available online. The website for the book is, it's just my name, alexandranatapoff.com, and there are links to all these resources there for folks who are interested.
And let me mention the name of the book, Punishment Without Crime, Alexandra Natapoff, N-A-T-A-P-O-F-F. Professor and attorney Alexandra Natapoff, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much.
Alexandra, I'm a true fan, and congratulations on another really brilliant book. Best of luck. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Our society, nuclear weapons that can destroy all creation are taken as a normal, even as inevitable, part of life. In a dramatic action to break what they call the crime of silence, seven Catholic peace activists entered the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April to perform an act of symbolic disarmament. They used hammers to follow the prophecy of Isaiah, to beat swords into plowshares, and they poured blood to make holy what was evil in a sacramental action. Kings Bay is home port to six ballistic missile Trident submarines, each of which deploy 16 Trident missiles carrying four or more warheads of at least 100 kilotons apiece. The Hiroshima bomb was only 14 kilotons. Each submarine thus has the destructive power of at least 500 Hiroshima bombs. The Plowshares 7 face up to 25 years in federal prison. Their trial is coming up next month. Theirs was the latest of 100 Plowshare actions around the world since 1980. We speak today with two of the defendants, Martha Hennessy and Carmen Trotta.
Martha and Carmen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Joy to be here. Thank you.
Please tell us about what you did in Georgia last April. How did you get on the base, and what did you do there?
Getting on the base was, oddly enough, sort of remarkably easy. It did take cutting a couple of fences with bolt cutters and stepping onto the base. We then walked for a very long time. It had to be nearly an hour on the base. We did this on a road, on an asphalt road on the base. We would have, if someone would have come, we would have gone into the trees to hide, but there was no need for that. So, I mean, just the notion of the security on the base is interesting to ponder. So an hour on that road, at a couple of points, the road was sort of completely lit. There was one, you know, and you would think you would be detected in some way. There was also a totally lit up area that seemed to have a place where cars went through. And we walked right by that. And there had to be people in it. It was entirely lit. And we were not apprehended. And then we had a plan that allowed us to break up into three different sections of the base. So the group of seven of us split into three groups to try and address three different areas of the base.
What time was this? Late at night?
It was late at night, so much so that we began the action on April 4th, and the action ended on April 5th.
And what did you do once you were in your three separate groups?
Well, my group went to what is called Swift Ant, the Strategic Weapons Facility Administration Building, and it was there that we posted our indictment. We held our banners. We posted our banners. We put up crime scene tape, and we poured blood on the doorway.
And what did the banners say specifically?
One said it was the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder, and one banner said the ultimate logic of genocide, of racism is genocide, and the other banner said the ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide. And Carmen had a banner as well.
And our banner very simply said, I was just Steve Kelly and Liz McAllister, who I should mention right now are both in jail and have remained in jail now for 11 months. And we went to what we thought was the heart of darkness, the heart of the base, which is where the nuclear weapons were stored, and tried to get as close to them as we could. So cut through two fences into a lethal force area. So did a very frightening, and they lit up by middle of the night with Klieg lights all over the place. Every time we did something, every time we cut a fence, we held the banner up and took a picture of ourselves. When they finally reacted to us, when the military finally sort of lights started going on and the one truck pulled up, we held up the banner that said nuclear weapons immoral and illegal. And the illegal aspect of it is interesting because it doesn't seem like the courts have the power to face that. And it is absolutely clear. Francis Boyle wrote an affidavit for us. He also wrote an affidavit about the INF treaty. And so it is very difficult to get that across to the courts. The courts do not want to hear that. And we keep putting it before them. And it's there on our sign, and it's in the evidence. And it's an old sign. It's an old plowshare sign. It's been used a number of times.
What crimes were you charged with? I assume trespassing?
Yes. Our charges are four charges. One, a misdemeanor, and three felonies. Conspiracy, trespass, depredation of naval property, and destruction of government property are the charges.
When the military came, did they have weapons? Were they pointing them at you?
So once again, quite frankly, the response was very slow. We were in a lethal force area for a long time. They are at a great distance and the light goes on. It takes them a long time to come to us. When they finally come to us, they sat in the truck for what must have been 5 minutes without coming out of the truck. And I could barely see them through the glass. Then when they did come out of the truck, my first response was they were stunningly young. They were very young men. And they did have guns. They did not point their guns at us. They pointed their guns toward the ground in front of us. And they began to issue orders to us. We said very quickly, we came in peace, that we meant them no harm, that we were all American citizens, that none of us are armed. And just to try and calm them down if that was... Actually, what I came to think, I think what most of us came to think, was that they were not so much offended, or the only thing that they were anxious about was whether or not they were doing their jobs properly, whether or not they were standing right, whether or not they were asking us the right questions or saying the right things or had the right demeanor.
This was probably their first real encounter.
Yes. Yeah, and there was, so then it took a long time. They were stood before us a long time. They wouldn't allow us to speak to them. We wanted to read them our statement, our indictment. They didn't want to hear that. They told us to take everything out of our pockets. They began to do things to demand that we basically undress. And then finally, when word really hit, trucks and lights started coming out of everywhere.
This is frightening to me on a different level, in that if a real adversary were trying to get in there to do destruction, but their response time is so low.
The level of security regarding these hair trigger alert weapons is what we really want to focus on.
Carmen, Martha, what is your legal defense? Are nuclear weapons illegal under international law? Isn't there a ruling by the International Court of Justice on that point?
We feel that there are many treaties in place that really should be putting a stop to this arms race, and they've just been neglected. And right now we have the INF treaty at risk, and we feel that if the federal courts would allow us to have expert testimony regarding the legality of nuclear weapons, we would have a decent case. But they have managed to squelch that.
I think really if you go back to, going back to World War II, so the United States bombs Hiroshima and Nagasaki, decimates those two cities. But prior to that, we had decimated 67 cities in Japan. During the war in Korea, the order was given to bomb every town, city, and structure in the country. When we ran out of cities in North Korea, we bombed the nation's four or five dams. I don't remember, it's four or five. The United States actually began to become accustomed to committing war crimes. These were war crimes. The bombing of extensive areas of cities are war crimes. So it's not merely nuclear weapons that are necessarily war crimes, because they are too large an explosion, of vast explosions. But we have become sort of accustomed to it. And perhaps people in the United States think it is legal. But if you... The law derives from international humanitarian law from decades ago. And if you look into that system, it's really quite clear that the nuclear weapons are necessarily illegal, which is what Francis Boyle does brilliantly.
How does your case involve the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
Yes, that is the defense that we are currently using. That has not been used in the past. I believe Phil and Liz did attempt to use that defense in the 1980s. And were thwarted. And so we are currently waiting from the courts to hear about our motion to dismiss based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
But it's not the Religious Freedom Restoration Act comes later. What Liz and Phil did is they had written up their own religious freedom, the sense of why they had acted, and that ought to be respected. For us, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a solution to a problem.
It was written in 93.
Okay, yeah, right, so it's later than right. The problem was that there was a recipe that the courts had come up with that would just destroy Plowshares' actions or not allow you to have what we would consider a fair trial, the ability to speak plainly before a jury for why we did what we did. The courts want to use motions in limine to completely limit our speech. No talk of religion, but not only that, no talk of what our real quest was. So they can say, here's the question. Did you cut the lock? Well, yeah, we cut the lock. That's the end of the question. That means you broke the law. Did you conspire together? Well, admit to that and you've broken the law. And that's all they want to know. With the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, we believe that we may get a chance to speak directly to the jurors about what our religious motivation was. In addition, if we can prove that these were sincerely held religious beliefs, then the government needs to use the least restrictive means of protecting their compelling interest. So it could, used rightly, it could be a way that the government would use properly, really, if the government would actually begin to discern or try to discern itself why we were actually there, who these people actually are, what's in their hearts. We might be able to get a more decent verdict than any of the Plowshares actions have in the past.
Daniel Ellsberg, in his book The Doomsday Machine, writes that nuclear war has nearly occurred 20 to 30 times in our history. These missiles are on hair trigger. What does that mean?
The Trident nuclear sub-missile system, I understand, is capable of striking anywhere on the planet within 15 minutes. And, yes, we've had a history of near misses, near accidents. We've had two Soviet soldiers save the planet twice. And Daniel Ellsberg does an excellent job of delineating that whole history. We have been planning on this for decades now, and it's an utter miracle that there hasn't been an accident.
Well, it should be known, we brought Ellsberg books on the base with us. We laid it down. We want it in as evidence, and we'd love to get him to come and testify at our trial. And I do think that he would do that if he knew in advance that he would be able to speak before a jury.
Let me ask you why you maintain that nuclear weapons are immoral. What religious belief do you hold that brings you to that conclusion?
We're Roman Catholic.
The Roman Catholic Church speaks of the slavery of war. We had to do this for the court. And if you go to some of the Gaudium Expes from Paul VI at the Vatican Council, they lay out what they actually think of war, and they've been really quite clear on nuclear weapons for a long time. But even the church really quite agrees that the massive destructions, the war crimes that we spoke about earlier, the bombing of extensive areas of civilian populations is clearly illegal. The very first thing that the church, the ancient church, after Jesus was crucified, the very first thing that the church does is that it opens up to all the nations of the world, because we are all brothers and sisters. Because the Catholic Church, if you go deeply into the teaching, it's sort of phenomenal, the respect that they say is demanded, the deference to human life, any person. I'm not saying that Christians live that way in particular. It's very unusual. All the evidence in the world points to the fact that Jesus Christ was a pacifist. Pacifism within the Christian community is far less than, vastly under 1%, huh?
Well, may I read you the words that Dorothy wrote when we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, this is very...
I appreciate that, yeah. Because...
Very faith-based.
You're Dorothy Day's great-granddaughter. Yes, please read her.
So this is written in September of 1945, shortly after the first strike of dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
This is stunning. I love this.
Mr. Truman was jubilant. President Truman. True man. What a strange name, come to think of it. We refer to Jesus Christ as true God and true man. Truman is a true man of his time in that he was jubilant. He was not a son of God, brother of Christ, brother of the Japanese, jubilating as he did. He went from table to table on the cruiser, which was bringing him home from the Big Three conference, telling the great news. Jubilant, the newspaper said. Jubilate Deo, we have killed 318,000 Japanese. That is, we hope we have killed them, the Associated Press on page 1, column 1 of the Herald Tribune says. The effect is hoped for, not known. It is to be hoped that they are vaporized, our Japanese brothers scattered, men, women, and babies, to the four winds, over the seven seas. Perhaps we will breathe their dust into our nostrils, feel them in the fog of New York in our faces, feel them in the rain on the hills of Easton. This is the mystical body of Christ that she is completely aware of.
Thank you for bringing that in to read to us, Martha. Please tell our listeners what your background is. The granddaughter of the great Catholic worker, Dorothy Day. Talk about how you came to your beliefs.
Well, I was raised Catholic, born and raised Catholic, born here in New York City, raised in Vermont, seventh of nine grandchildren. And from a very, very early age, I was made to understand through both my mother and my grandmother that you do pay attention to the suffering of others, and you do feel that suffering, and you do respond to that. So that was the setting that I grew up in, and I worked for many years as an occupational therapist, and I was not a practicing Catholic in my 20s, 30s, and 40s. I returned to the Catholic Church, and then I returned to the Catholic worker, retired from occupational therapy, and it was a long route to being prepared for a plowshares action, but I finally got there.
Do you both get criticized for a strategy that inevitably results in arrest and prison time? And what is your answer to people who criticize you?
Well, we have to raise our voice in whatever way we can. And I certainly feel like the U.S. and Russian nuclear policy right now is untouchable. It's a completely undemocratic process. And so, no, I don't want to go to prison. And I feel that we are upholding the law. I mean, Dan Berrigan talked a lot about this. Who are the criminals here? And we have a history of nonviolent direct action.
Philip Berrigan once said that dissent without resistance is consent. He also wrote at one point that unless you break the law, you have not touched the state. Yeah, you're putting your heart behind what your actions are. So I do think that it was a sort of Christian witness to do the action in this manner. Remember that at some point Christ says in the text that for this I was born, for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. And so I think that's what we attempted to do.
I saw when you came into the studio that you're both wearing ankle bracelets so that you can be monitored. And several of your comrades are in jail. Can you give us an update on the situation?
There are three of us in jail, Mark Colville, Liz McAllister, and Father Steve Kelly. Four of us, Patrick O'Neill, Martha, myself, and Claire Grady, are all out of jail. Those who are out are all on ankle monitors. Previously, we were in home confinement, which is much more restrained. So you can't leave the house unless you have a reason to go somewhere, a doctor's appointment, a religious service, but it has to be a mass, or it can't be necessarily, if it's a social gathering, you can go to the baptism, you can't go to the party afterwards. So it is their decision when you can move anywhere outside of the house itself. That, after 2 months, we were able to come off of that. The judge at the time allowed us to come off of that and to go on curfew, which is much less restrictive. Still somewhat restrictive to not be able to go out after 8:30 at night. And more, because of the ankle monitors, you have to stay within a district. And so now we have, you know, Patrick is from North Carolina, Claire Grady is from Ithaca. To get them to come to New York City, we have to file all sorts of requests with the court. We have to get permission. So rather than be able to do this naturally, rather than to be able to travel freely and see each other when we want, we have to constantly go back to the court. So there is a degree to which it prevents us from preparing for our trial.
Steve Kelly was not offered bond and bail because he has an outstanding on the West Coast, the twin to Kings Bay Trident, Kitsap. Trident nuclear facility. Liz McAllister would not take the ankle monitor. She wanted personal recognizance because the whole justification is risk of flight and risk to the community, which are false premises. She turned 79 in jail, and Steve just turned 70. And Mark was out. He had to get skin cancer treatment. And then he went back in saying, this is like jail time and you don't get credit for it. And it was completely disrupting his works of mercy work at the New Haven Catholic Worker.
And when is your trial?
No date is set yet. We're thinking in April. We are still waiting for a decision from the courts on the motion to dismiss based on religious freedom.
How can people learn more about your case and keep up with what's going on and support you?
Well, there is an event at Fordham University on Sunday, the 17th of February. We would encourage you all to consider coming to that. It's at 2 p.m. at the Lincoln Center campus, 113 West 60th Street. And we will be showing the film by Helen Young called The Nuns, The Priests, The Bomb. And then the Kings Bay defendants will be speaking at that event. Our website is Kings Bay Plowshares 7, the numeral 7.org.
Has Trump opened the door to a new nuclear arms race? You know, he backed out of his nuclear treaty with Russia and the treaty with Iran, and now he wants to build new nuclear weapons and new submarines. Each one costs $5 billion apiece. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has that clock, you know, with the hand approaching midnight. You think it's gotten closer to midnight?
I think they did not move it. They kept it at 2 minutes with the INF treaty being withdrawn from. But someone else has given an assessment at 1 minute midnight. And yes, I think that Trump, with his nuclear posture review that came out a year ago, he is working towards making the weapons more usable. And he has every intention of using the nuclear sword of Damocles against the entire planet. I do believe that Russia has good faith intentions in trying to work out agreements.
We should all remember that there was a moment in time between Gorbachev and Reagan that Gorbachev offered complete nuclear disarmament to Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan wanted to accept it. Ronald Reagan was probably overruled by the military-industrial complex, and the military-industrial complex wanted Star Wars, and Reagan had to back down. But Russia actually offered complete nuclear disarmament. So it is the United States that is responsible for all of the nuclear forces that are presently on Earth, because we could have eliminated nuclear weapons years ago.
And we're the only first strike users.
And at this point, the INF Treaty goes, and then you have the START Treaty, which expires in 2021, unless it is voted on again. There is every indication that Donald Trump is going to get us out of the START Treaty also. And so for the first time since 1972, nuclear weapons will be entirely unregulated. Of course, this is also a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That goes without saying, and it's been persistently violated over the years.
Why does the threat of nuclear war not command the same attention and urgency as the climate change catastrophe?
I think Noam Chomsky has pointed out that these are the two greatest issues facing us at this point in time. But yes, I have children who are in their 30s and 40s, and they grew up without any sense of this duck and cover threat, the Cold War threat. So the latest generation has just been isolated from this issue altogether, and I think that the media plays a very important role in making sure that we don't talk about nuclear holocaust.
Are you getting support from the next generation?
My daughter, yes. My son, less so. But young people understand. They know what's at stake. They know that their future is absolutely compromised.
I mean, I don't think the moment has come yet where people actually realize. It's much easier for most people to look at global warming, sane people, and say, oh my God, something dramatic has to happen. That what is occurring is necessarily catastrophic unless we act now. And that's absolutely true. So the only existential threats to the United States are climate change, the nuclear system. The United States is an existential threat to the planet right now because of our sort of noncompliance in getting rid of the nuclear weapons and the irresponsibility of climate change. I mean, Trump is also, we're not thinking of cutting back on fossil fuels at all with this administration. Not even thinkable.
Who are your attorneys?
Oh, we have
I'm represented. The four men are going pro se, and as it stands now, the three women are represented. We have William Quigley out of New Orleans, Anna Leolid, and a local Brunswick, Georgia attorney by the name of Stephanie McDonald.
Bill Quigley, yes. National Lawyers Guild member, and a fine attorney, political attorney. You're in good hands, yes.
I wanted to ask you your thoughts on Paul Magno's statement. Paul has written, "If humans lose our capacity to act selflessly and sacrificially on behalf of future generations, we ultimately capitulate to death forces of our own creation, materially and spiritually." What were your thoughts when you read Paul's statement?
He's been with the movement for many years now. I find my experience with the Plowshares action is the greatest spiritual faith challenge in my lifetime. I mean, I feel we have to deliver ourselves up to be willing to point out that this naval base has the capacity to destroy the whole planet, and we are functioning as canaries in the coal mine, it seems.
Are there any points that we didn't touch on that you'd like to raise?
Well, the mayors, the U.S. Mayor's Council really is trying to do something about freezing the budget so that these funds for the upgrading of the nuclear arsenal are not made possible, and that we redirect all of these funds for human needs.
I guess I was thinking, in terms of listening to Paul's statement and Paul coming out of the Catholic Worker, and the Catholic Worker is sort of an enhanced faith environment, frankly. And I think there are that so many people go about their day-to-day lives on a very, I mean, in the United States, people do really work really quite hard often. A lot of people constantly striving just to get by, really. So we become habituated to an environment that excludes the thought of these larger questions. But more importantly, the other thing that excludes these questions being raised is our media. And I'm thinking we've been doing, the Catholic Worker has been hosting for a while, for a couple of years now, a vigil regarding Yemen and the war in Yemen, where the United States is once again complicit in war crimes with Saudi Arabia. So can we understand their suffering at all? MSNBC ran not a single program about Yemen in all of 2017 and has done almost nothing on it since. So it is sort of a forgotten war. There are 85,000 children have died sort of unnecessarily during the period of that war. And this has not shocked the conscience of the nation. It is not even recognized by the nation. It's not recognized by the media. So I know that's a, I know that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's understanding of fascism was when the corporations and the government merge, and we are there.
Carmen, Martha, Heidi and I respect you very much, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you every success in getting out the word, and we're here to support you in the future.
And we really look forward to the trial and hope that you have the opportunity to present expert witnesses and explain your religious defense.
All we're asking for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.